I want to turn first to Alexander Vostman. No, I'm sorry. Reverse the order. First to Dr. Robert Cutler, research fellow at the Institute of European and Russian Studies in Canada. He's got a long CV, very impressive academic pedigree and publications record, and we want to hear from him first. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me situate what I will be saying. In my role as chair yesterday, I made some remarks not directly relevant to the question of Europe or and the Caspian, or Euro-Caspian, if you like, energy. And I, as you see on the program, it says the regions associated with me are Central Asia, Russia, Caucasus, Eastern Europe, and I find myself on a panel that is called Energy in Europe. So learning that Alexander asked me to precede him and not knowing why, but learning nevertheless that he will not be discussing the green paper recently issued from the European Commission, and taking account of everything that we, all of the interesting things and important things that we did here yesterday concerning pipelines, for the sake of completion, I've chosen to assume the obligation to discuss very briefly the green paper because it is so recent and because it has not been discussed and perhaps will not be discussed again, leaving for the question period anything you wish to ask me about the Caucasus and Russia and the Caspian and the pipelines, which I'd be very interested to reply to. And in fact, what I will be doing, you will see that the discussion of the green paper that I undertake, in fact, will open out to those questions. So rather than proceeding from those regions towards Europe, starting with Europe and proceeding outwards, on the understanding that you, mutual understanding between yourself and myself, that I do not pretend to be a specialist in the details of the deregulation or the liberalization of the gas market in Europe. I have no idea what the energy mix foreseen by the Austrian government for its national population is 5 years hence. That having been said, a few remarks upon the green paper issued just a few weeks ago. One of the things that strikes a regular visitor to Europe is perhaps counterintuitive. Europe feels very small today. They look at China from the energy perspective. They look at China, they look at India, and feel that they are becoming less important energy consumer power. This is a slightly misdirected feeling, I believe, that results in fact from the fact that they feel marginalized on the world energy market, I think because they really don't have anything to bargain with, which is a different issue, but that is how they experience it, to bargain with against Russia, except for one thing I'll mention later. But they experience this as a feeling of marginalization on the energy market. It is frequently said that by Europeans that more coherence is needed between the policies of the EU and thus with those of the member states. But even following through on the green paper, to which I come very soon, even following through on its recommendations will not give the EU a more cohesive policy than coordination through the IEA in Paris already provides. Now, moving to the green paper itself, it is not called just an energy policy, but an energy strategy. It is a revision of the green paper from the year 2000, and the technical discussion, the detailed discussion of energy policy, is in fact relegated to a technical appendix of the new green paper, which bears the name Energy Strategy, with three targets, which it denotes competitiveness, sustainability, and security of supply. Now this triad, they don't call it a triad, but just repeats, in fact, that's a very loaded word in this town. I'm going to withdraw it. But this trio of targets repeats the priority areas, does no more than to repeat the priority areas enumerated by the Article on Energy in the draft Constitution of Europe. What do they mean briefly? Competitiveness signifies the completion of the internal market, developing network interconnections in the energy network, further integration of the European electricity grid, and research and innovation in such areas as clean coal, carbon sequestration, alternative fuels, energy, and new energy efficiency, and nuclear energy. Sustainability is synonymous with environment for this purpose, signifying renewable energy, energy efficiency, and emissions trading. And security of supply signifies international dialogue, the management of European oil and gas stocks, managing refining capacity and energy storage, and protection against terrorism. Now, the Green Paper itself has six chapters. The first one dealing with competitiveness, meaning the completion of the internal market and its liberalization. The second and the third chapter deal respectively with security of supply and energy mix, the latter of which has a security aspect and also a sustainability aspect. The fourth chapter deals with the need to integrate, a need for an integrated approach to climate change and energy efficiency, again a sustainability theme. The fifth chapter combines sustainability and security again with respect to innovation and research. And the sixth chapter is about, quote unquote, policy, common aims and vision through yearly reviews, contacts with producing and other consuming countries, relations with India and China, and so forth. Now, the Green Paper concludes on 15 proposals. I'm not going to enumerate them all, or even the majority of them, but simply to note that of these 15 proposals, six of them fall under the category of the sixth chapter on external relations, over which the EU has the least control amongst the three titles of sustainability, competitiveness, and security. Now, the EU does have an energy policy already, but this is on the level of the internal market. That is to say, it is rather like the technology policy in the early 80s, which was supposed to be a response to the Strategic Defense Initiative and ended up being half a German, half French, piecemeal and sectoral and unintegrated reply to technology development subsidized by the EU. That is to say that the EU policy as it now exists, energy policy, is a piecemeal approach because it is on the level of the internal market without a comprehensive legal framework or instrumentarium. Now, the Constitution of Europe would have made energy policy more visible and would have provided such a legal framework. Indeed, the idea of creating a high representative for energy, a kind of Solana for energy, was floated during the drafting of the Constitution for Europe, although it was not incorporated into it. What is new in the Green Paper is to provide for regular annual energy reviews. So what there is now in Europe is not a static legal basis for an energy policy, but a dynamic political basis. This result may have been inevitable, given not just the clash of prerogatives between the Union and its member states, on the one hand, but also, on the other, the fundamental philosophical conflict between national legal systems based, on the one hand, on common law, and on the other hand, on a heritage deriving from a tradition of the Napoleonic Code. Now, there are differences between internal and external energy policy. And one of the things the EU could have done or could do is to influence the energy mix of consumption. However, Commission President Barroso has declared that the Commission, quote, does not intend to interfere with the right of each member state to decide its own energy mix. Well, also, the EU could choose to put into place legal instruments and frameworks, but it faces the contradiction in national legal traditions, which I have just mentioned. The different sectors in the energy field have different situations and different requirements. This is true everywhere and in Europe, and it makes a piecemeal approach more workable and the integration more difficult. Energy security in natural gas means diversification of supplies and the increasing of reserves and stocks. For oil, energy security means the same thing as that, but the types of investments differ, the relevant technologies differ, and also the character of the natural resource is distinct from that of gas. For electricity, the interconnections of network grids are unlike the kinds of interconnections you have amongst gas pipelines. These differences may be multiplied. I come to the question of Russia, which even if one wishes to avoid the external links of the EU, is unavoidable. And I mentioned that the EU feels diminished in the world energy market, and that this is a misdirected feeling from the fact that it has very little to bargain with against Russia because it needs the energy, but has nothing to offer except one thing, and I will tell you what it is that what Russia needs from the EU is really a small thing, but it's the only thing, although it's very important to some people in Russia, which is the revision of the Corfu Protocol, which regulates the importation into the EU from Russia of nuclear materials for reactors for nuclear energy. There is a 20% quantitative restriction, not written into the protocol itself, but subsequently defined by administrative documents. This QR was set by the EU in the 1990s because the market was then being flooded by decommissioned nuclear fuel for reactors from dismantled nuclear warheads. Of course, this is no longer 1994, but Russia has nevertheless been unable to have the quantitative restriction lifted or increased, despite engaging skilled lobbyists in Brussels for this purpose. Aside from this, however, there is next to nothing that the EU can offer to Russia as a bargaining chip in other energy-related negotiations. Indeed, two of the compelling priorities of the EU work, well, not against Russia, but at least against Gazprom. These are the liberalization of markets and the diversification of supply. Gazprom has argued that long-term contract structures are essential to support investment decisions and reserve development in pipeline investments, and in the gas sector, this is by and large true. However, the rise of neoliberal and neoliberal thinking in Europe militates against long-term contracting, although there does seem to be some common ground being found here. Second, Gazprom has hedged its bets on long-term contracts, nevertheless, by diversifying downstream, setting up trading operations in Europe, and investing where it can in European infrastructure, such as the Zeebrugge-Bakken interconnector. And the Gazprom is handling this pretty well, actually, although perhaps other aspects of its operations it is handling less well. So the diversification of supply is a threat to Gazprom from Europe. I'll just run through very briefly a list. Many of them were mentioned yesterday. I'll be happy to discuss them. I underline in the question period. There's the Nabucco pipeline from Turkey and further on that is to go to Austria. This is a direct threat to Gazprom's market share in Central Europe. Turkey is negotiating with Greece to follow on through one of the TENs into Italy, which is Gazprom's second largest European customer. Turkey has been talking again with Turkmenistan about routing Turkmen gas through Turkey into Western Europe, and so on. I will save my remarks about liquefied natural gas markets if there are further any questions. Now, bear in mind that the IEA, and in fact the president, of the head of the director of the IEA, says that Russia does not invest enough to provide Europe with what it needs by 2010, let alone twice that quantity by 2030. Gazprom, according to this, will be unable to meet even current commitments to Europe without new important investments. But leading natural gas businessmen who represent all European industrial association assert, and I quote from a meeting 10 days ago in Brussels, investment is impossible in Russia, unquote. They do not have confidence in Russia, not just because of Gazprom's and the government's strong-arm tactics with Ukraine, but also because of the economic and demographic situation in Russia, which they see to be in decline. Nevertheless, the company Wintershall asserts that it will invest over 1 billion euros in the North European gas project, or at least this was the case before Gaz de France was solicited to come on board with it, and EON is one of Gazprom's partners. Technically, of course, investing in the NEGP is not quite the same as investing in Russia. The question of cross-ownership has been talked up, and Wintershall is in favor of this, but Russia seems to seek cross-ownership in one direction only, by which I mean Russian companies becoming co-proprietors of Western firms without necessarily facilitating reciprocity in this respect. Now, again, the EU and Gazprom. Gazprom wants the EU to decide for its member states. Gazprom wants a single interlocutor on the European side. They want EBRD and EIB participation. Indeed, support on a financial level seems critical, since Gazprom does not appear interested in serious investment of its own resources, preferring to rely on partners. Tight ties with Central Asian gas producers have militated against Gazprom taking seriously its own deficiencies, which the IEA recognizes and which are becoming increasingly evident to observers, and some of which were highlighted in presentations yesterday. It is worth mentioning just a few. Am I going to find
a couple more minutes?
Yes, a couple more minutes. I'm coming to this is the penultimate point.
Excellent.
It is worth mentioning a few other complicating factors in the financial sphere, which I beg leave to mention has been not sufficiently stressed during these 2 days. The problems in the financing of energy development, exploration development in the petrochemical sector. There has been, in recent years, an important shift from equity financing to debt financing. There are more risky projects, more numerous risky projects in frontier provinces. Financial institutions have therefore an increased role, and therefore the cost of financing projects themselves becomes an issue in the choice of projects to finance. Indeed, the availability and the cost of raising capital itself has become one of the major factors influencing competitiveness, and its importance continues to increase over time. Financial costs have become a significant component in decision-making, such that natural advantage is no longer the most important factor. Now, the Energy Charter Treaty provides multiplier legal effects in decreasing risks with consequential economic results in cost reduction. The ECT is, I add to the list of matters I'm more than willing to take questions on during the question period. To conclude, the sixth chapter of the Green Paper mentions a quote-unquote common regulatory space, that it encourages to be created, expanding from the Southeast Europe Energy Community, which in October, November last year was set into place on top of the Balkan Security Pact. The EU encourages to develop Turkish participation, Ukrainian participation in an expanded Southeast European energy community, still rather hazy, but with Energy Charter Treaty provisions being called down from the WTO, facilitating most favored nation status for what used to be called most favored nation status for investments, regardless of the country of source of those investments, and eventually to include the Maghreb and the Mashrek into a pan-European energy community that will assist in giving the Europeans both a security of supply of energy and a feeling of security of energy supply on that. And not omitting to take into account also eventually the Caspian countries, which are and so forth, and the Caspian countries as well. And having finally reached the Caspian from Europe, I conclude. Thank you.
Well done.